Bill Bailey has been coming to Australia for several decades now, moonlighting as a hugely popular comedian and using that as a jumping-off point to explore the natural world. This all started in the West Country of England, between Bath and Bristol, where Bill Bailey grew up. He and his dad would often go out into the countryside to go birding, and this left a deep impression on Bill. As a school student, Bill Bailey was the boy most likely, until he unfortunately discovered punk music. And to the horror of his teachers, he all but lost interest in formal education. Now a father himself, and having failed to become a famous punk rocker, Bill Bailey has returned to that boyhood desire to know as much about wild places and wild creatures as he possibly can. He's made numerous nature documentaries all over the world about birds and primates. He is, in fact, an obsessively curious man. It's Bill's ambition to understand everything in the universe, and he's almost 35% of the way there. Bill Bailey has written and illustrated a beautiful book called Bill Bailey's Remarkable Guide to British Birds. Hello, Bill.
Hello, Richard.
Can we start with owls? I feel like I need to start with owls with you, if that's all right.
Absolutely. I have no objection to that at all.
What's the closest you've ever come to an owl?
Well, the closest I've come to an owl is very close. I once bought an owl from a restaurant in southern China.
How did that happen?
We were travelling through China, myself and my family, on a holiday, not work-related, and one of the sort of, the aims of the trip was to try and garner as much information about the country as possible, and to see as much of it as we could. So we ticked off the touristy places. We went to the Wall and the Summer Palace, and we went to Xi'an to see the Terracotta Warriors, and it was all marvellous. But then we wanted to see something a little bit more of the real China, a bit about what China is now. And China, of course, is huge industrial sort of powerhouse. And, of course, going along with that, there's a lot of e-waste that goes to China. A lot of recycling goes on. And there's a part of southeastern China, Guangdong province, where a lot of this e-waste ends up. And it's like no other bit of China. It's the bit of China they don't really want you to see. But we're curious about that, myself and my wife and my son. And so we thought, let's go there. So we ended up in this place, and there was a restaurant we were taken to. And in the restaurant, along with all the usual things of prawns and crabs and crustaceans, were some oddities which were clearly sort of not the normal things you see in Chinese restaurants. And there were civet cats. And I noticed a giant salamander, which is on the CITES endangered list. These were things offered for sale to eat. And the owl was in a cage, and I noticed straight away that it was probably a Eurasian eagle owl, not an endangered species by any means, but certainly not one renowned for its taste.
Hang on, the owl was in a cage? And this was for the benefit of the patrons who may decide they want to eat it?
Yes.
In what form would they eat this?
I didn't get that far, because...
So it's like fish in a tank, in other words.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Basically, yeah. I'll have that one. Well, that owl looks tasty. Yes, we're in a black bean, like a black bean sauce.
Sichuan pepper.
Sichuan,
all of that. Yes.
Yeah. And so we looked at this thing, and I said to my wife, cracked. I said, we have to get it out of here. We can't let this owl languish here in this cage like this. There were other things as well, the cormorants, various other birds. So we basically haggled with the restaurant owners, bought the owl off them. I know this sounds like some terrible joke, but it sort of made sense to them that we wanted to take away the owl. This sort of...
and you did.
And we did. So they were like, there was a lot of talk with Cantonese, and then it was like, no, they want to take it. Oh, right, okay. So then of course, fine. So they went off and got some packaging tape, and there's three of them. They've got hold of this thing, and they are big creatures. I don't know if you've ever been near a Eurasian eagle owl.
They're powerful.
They are huge. One of the largest owls there is, and they have immensely powerful talons. And they could do you a bit of damage. The beak, not so much, but they are big, and this thing was angry. Oh, it was angry, which gave me a great deal of hope, because I thought, it hasn't been there a long time.
Oh,
it's not been habituated.
Its spirit hasn't been broken.
It's not been broken. So they grabbed this thing, wrapped it up in packing tape, and wrestled it into a cardboard box, and then put packaging tape around the cardboard box, and then there you go. So it went back to work.
What with this shuffling sort of noise?
And it was rattling around in this box. And then I just thought, I don't know what the hell have we done? And we got in the taxi, got in this cab, right, let's go. And the taxi driver was looking at us, what the hell have you got in there? And we were like, it's an owl. Oh, all right. And just kind of shrugged. Okay.
Crazy guayla.
Crazy guayla with an owl purchase. Mm. So and then I thought, well, what the hell are we going to do with it? And I honestly didn't know what to do. And so I looked on. I thought briefly, as you do in these situations, I don't know when you've bought an owl in China, but.
No, I haven't.
No, all right. No? Well, let me tell you what you think, right? You start to think, have I been a bit gung-ho here? If I just let the thing go, is it going to just... Am I committing it to a fate worse? And is it going to just not survive? Is it just going to, you know, flap around helplessly and be devoured by predators? Or am I actually doing a fate? I don't know. I was in a dilemma. So what I did was... I thought about various options. I've got some, you know, friends that work in conservation, people that work in zoos and places around the world, just because of the contacts I have. And then I thought, no, do you know what? I've got a friend of mine, a guy I know, who, of course, this has got people I know. I know an owl expert who works at London Zoo. So I phoned him. And I left a message on his voicemail. I said, "Oh, hi, it's Bill. I'm in China. I bought an owl. Can you bring me back?" And
he did.
And he did, yeah, he did, pretty promptly, I have to say. And he said, well, what sort of is it? And I said, well, look, as far as I can, you know, make out, it's a Eurasian eagle. It's probably big, it was big, and the females are a good head size taller than the males.
So what would you mean, like 2 feet?
No. I mean, like, you know, it's huge, it's like, you know, this size, 3 feet.
Like 4 feet?
Oh, yeah, it's an enormous thing. So he said, well, look. He said, what condition's it in? I said, it looks pretty good. I said, it's angry. That's all I can tell you. It's not happy at all. And he goes, well, that's good. Is there any way you can give it a rat? And I said, well, not right now. A
couple of minutes, though.
give me a couple of minutes. I'll get back to you. And so anyway, so he said, well, look, he said, it'd probably be all right. He just, look, and then, you know what? I did actually pursue there's other options, zoos. I found them. I just thought, you know what? I'm just going to commit. I'm condemning this owl to months sitting in quarantine while people fill out forms and decide what to do with it, what will be its fate. And so in the end, we just thought, oh, come on, let's just let it go. Let's let it go. And so that was not was another whole thing, way more difficult than I thought it was going to be.
How did you release this into the wild?
We communicated with this taxi driver. By now, he didn't know what the hell's going on. We told him, can you take us up into the woods, forest, you know, where I was looking in my phrase book. You know, there's nothing in your standard phrase book.
Can you drive me to a forest where I can release my owl?
Is there an area which is conducive to release an owl?
Take me to the nearest owl releasing space.
It's not in the getting to know you section. Hi. Are you new in town? Do you know anywhere I could release an owl? And so, hi, you're a good dancer. Do you know anywhere? So anyway, so he took us up into quite a remote village, and I thought, well, this is perfect. There's a bit of cover. There's lots of forest. We're away from people. And this thing, by now, I mean, I've sort of checked up on this, but the Eurasian eagle owl has an enormous range. And I mean, it's Asia and Europe, as the name would suggest. You find them in the, you know, in forests in southern Europe, and you find them in the furthest eastern fastnesses of China. So this thing is pretty handy. It's top of the food chain. It's apex predator. It isn't a shrinking violet. It can look after itself. But the trouble was, it was taped up quite severely with this tape. So we had to get the tape off, because if it had flown off with the tape on, it would have died.
A dangerous moment when you're trying to chop off the packaging tape off an owl?
Yes, that is it's tricky because, you know, we want to get the tape off, but also, you know, these talons are huge and they would do you some damage. And if it grabbed you and you just went, oh yeah, like that and let go and it flew off, it would you would have condemned it to probably to starve. So there was three of us, me, the cab driver, who by now is thinking this is the weirdest day of his life. It's dark, he's got the taxi lights on, shining on the owl. And he's, I mean, I'm going, have you got any scissors? Come on. Scissors. And he got, God bless him, in his glove box, he had a pair of paper scissors. Like, I don't know how, but he, we got these out. So the, between the three of us, me, my wife, and my son, bless him, was filming the whole thing, which was a brilliant thing to do. We managed to cut the packaging tape off and got it off around his legs, round his wings. And it then, there was a moment where all the tape came off and it just sort of sprung away from us and kind of turned around and looked at us with tremendous hatred, burning fury in its eyes. And I thought, this is brilliant. What a, this is a wild animal, red in tooth and claw. And it just hissed menacingly at us, like this. And then none of us knew what we'd do, just standing there, like, transfixed. And then it turned round and then just flew off into the night. And we were just jubilant. I mean, I was sort of, I kind of lost my mind. I was just jumping in the air. No, we were all cheering. Even the cab driver was now swept up at all this. He was kind of half-heartedly, yay, whatever. And this thing just flew off. And it was one of the most wonderful things I've ever seen.
That must be one of the greatest moments of your life.
It was.
And are you telling that story on stage to an audience at all? Mm. And if so, do they have trouble believing it, given that it might sound like a surrealist flight of fancy? It's such an unlikely story.
Indeed. And indeed, that's very true. And in fact, funny enough, I told the story on stage. I didn't really think about it as a story to tell on stage until I realised, well, it's actually quite a great story. But there was no ending. The ending was, and it flew off. You know, and so people just kind of think, oh, that's a great story, Bill. No, probably made that up. But anyway, and then months later, I was, you know, when you sort of stopped travelling and I'd looked at the sort of footage that my son had taken. And there was a friend of ours, an Indonesian friend of ours, Mita, was with us as well. And she'd taken some footage. And between the two of them, I stitched together what was a little short film of the owl being, you know, the tape being taken off and it flying off. And so a friend of mine, Joe, I work with a lot on shows, he edited very cleverly the thing together, made it into a little short film. And then I would show it at the end of the performance. And I'd play some music over it. And it was it was just a little postscript to the whole show. And it was extraordinary. People realised, oh, my God, this actually happened. This was a real thing. And the reaction was extraordinary. It ranged from just people smiling to weeping. People weeping. I really had not predicted that at all.
It's nice to know good things happen in the world sometimes. That's
well,
why.
I suppose.
In, after the most unlikely kind of situation like that.
Yeah, I guess.
You spent quite a bit of time with owls. It's an odd thing. I don't think I've ever said that to a guest before. In the process, you must see how they are around humans. What are we to an owl? Are we just like some part of the furniture, or are we a threat to them? Are they frightened of us, or are they disdainful of us?
Most of the time, we don't cross their paths that often. So I think they're probably just they're indifferent to us. In Britain, certainly, owls have a rather unfortunate intersection with people, in as much as barn owls tend to get hit by cars at a terrible regularity because their method of hunting is a sort of a low swoop over a field, which then suddenly there's a road there and suddenly barn owls are getting taken out. And also, it sounds like some kind of weird, this can't be true, but there's less barns, you know, so barn owls don't have anywhere to, their habitat's being encroached on. So they're kind of more fearful now, I think, probably than at any time. They're probably, if you see a human, they'd back off.
But they have a kind of 3D hearing system. Mm. How does that work, to your knowledge?
They have this sort of concave face, which acts as a fantastic sort of like a dish to, you know, sort of process sound. It sort of amplifies the sound. They have incredible hearing. They have this extraordinary facility. I mean, they can hunt by just they can hear the tiniest movements and of voles, you know, which again, I feel sorry for voles because they've got no chance, you know. They think they're fine. you can't see me down here. But, you know, there's a barn owl couldn't hear its heart beating from, you know.
Oh, my God, really? It's like that, isn't it?
I mean, it's extraordinary. They can pick up the tiniest movements. So they hunt by sound and they're able to pinpoint exactly. They have asymmetrical ears. And so it somehow, there's some physics there, which of course I wouldn't be able to explain to you, but somehow that allows them to kind of calibrate exactly where these things are.
Well, like stereoscopic vision.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you approach the object from two different points and
exactly.
so forth. You know where it
That's
is in
right.
space as a result.
Yeah.
I was speaking to a colleague earlier today about owls who does some work in natural history, and she says, you know, of course, barn owls, they will consume the animal whole,
yes.
and then they cough up the bones and fur afterwards.
That's right.
Oh, my God, have you ever seen such a thing? Just to see an owl go, like that. That's right, and cough up a mouse skin and bones
yes,
like
it
that.
Is. It is a perfect pellet. I've seen these things, and they're quite beautiful in a way. They're just it's a perfect sort of sphere of little bones and skulls and all sorts, if that's the sort of thing you like.
That's quite terrifying in
yes.
its own way. They must have some kind of internal sorting system then that sort of says
yes.
this, not that.
Yes, that's good. Keep that.
Yeah.
That's for the pellet.
The standard image we have of an owl is the wise creature perched majestically on its branch. But have you seen one in full flight? Isn't there a real majesty of an owl in flight?
Oh, it is, yes. Often when I'm coming back from a show in England or, you know, through Britain really, you'll see a tawny owl. And tawny owls are nocturnal, so you sort of tend to see them just sort of flitting across the road. But the most beautiful sight, I think, of any bird I've ever seen really is a barn owl hunting at dusk, because their flight is silent. I mean, it's extraordinary to imagine, but they don't make any sound. And, of course, that's part of their sort of, you know, their evolutionary plan is because, you know, their hunting is based on stealth. So the prey have absolutely no idea what's happening, no idea what's coming. And they sort of resemble, they're almost like some like a giant moth, you know, flitting across a field at dusk. And they have this sort of ethereal beauty, this beautiful heart-shaped face and these white wings. And to the point that through history, they've, I think, probably accounted for many, many accounts of, you know, supernatural eyewitness accounts of wraiths and spirits and unnatural
yes.
creatures, you know, oh, when there's a death and then there's a wraith. And that. It was most probably a barn owl because they have a sort of an earthly shriek which they make, which, of course, would have been interpreted by the fearful.
As a wraith.
As
right.
some kind of wraith.
So they're quite uncanny in
yeah.
the way they appear then as well. When did you start birding or twitching? Or what do you prefer as a term, birding or twitching?
Well, twitching implies an extra level of commitment, which I probably don't have. That involves a lot of people having pages and being constantly on call.
Right.
There's a spoonbill in the River Tor. Go, go, go. You know, I'm not quite at that level. I'm more sort of, I'm there for the aesthetic.
How nice. I'd like to have you here for the whole hour, so that's nice you won't be called away.
Yeah, I won't be called away.
Right.
No, okay.
Good.
Okay. Some rarities blown in.
But when did this start for you, Bill?
I think when I was a kid.
How old
you know,
would this have been?
Probably, I suppose, the age of 7 or 8, really. I had an observer book of birds, which was the kind of default bird reference book, this little tiny pocket book. And it was just a little hardback book that you could, you know, write in, or, you know, the pages are quite thick, so you know, you could sort of bend them down, write little notes in them. I think my dad gave it to me, and it was in sort of woven into like a family day out where we lived in the west of England between Bath and Bristol, very close to the countryside. So it doesn't take long to get out into the countryside. We would go to, there's a bird sanctuary, there's wetland centres, there's even just the local reservoir where we would go, just to, because it was covered in, you know, waterfowl and ducks. And me and my granddad would just sat there and watch all the, and he knew the names of all the birds as well, so he'd point them out. And there was one particular one, the great crested grebe, which was like the kind of, that was like the sort of star spot. And if you could get that, then that's lunch, you know.
Right.
So it was a sort of, it was a kind of a ritual.
And were you in it for the birds or for your dad's company?
No, I think it was just more of a sort of quite a companionable sort of thing to do. It was like a, you know, it gave a kind of shape to the day. It was there was a purpose to our outing. You know, it was, we would go and we would walk around the lake and we'd see many birds we could see. Then we'd go and have lunch and then we'd come home. And it didn't just struck me as a kind of that we were bird watching. It was just part of the day. It's always sort of, you know, gives a kind of purpose to being in the outdoors. And I think that's really what I took from it into adult life, which was the fact that if you go looking for birds, you'll very often find yourself in a very in a sometimes a beautiful part of the world, or you'll be out in the you'll be outdoors, you know. So
it's funny, you know, this is what a hunter has told me she found pleasurable about hunting. It wasn't so much the hunting, it was everything else that goes on. The hunting distracts the conscious mind,
yes,
while the rest of the mind is absorbing the absolute deep pleasure and deep sensory immersion in nature. That's what you're, it sounds similar to what you're describing.
It's very much that. It's very much so, yes.
And what was the first bird you remember watching very, very closely?
I think probably just the garden birds, you know, in growing up. As I mentioned in the book, we had an old cider press table in the garden, which was a stone tab, just tabla. It's a huge lump of stone on a big block. And it had a sort of channel which ran all the way around the outside. And when I was a kid, of course, I had no idea what this was, but it's only in later life I realised what it was. It was the base of a cider press, and apples would be piled onto this thing, and a huge press would be, you know, forced down onto it, and then the apple juice would go around the channel into some sort of receptacle. And it was used as a kind of bird table. So I used to go out there, and we'd see enormous numbers of birds. My mum would go out and then put scraps on it. So probably things like, you know, the most common, really, the robins, the chaffinches, the blue tits, blackbirds, you know, enormous quantities of pigeons, you know, all kinds of finches. You know, you get the sort of the winter visitor, the field fares. I got a sense then of the kind of seasonal change and the way that you'd see different birds at different times of the year.
How chuffed are you to have a book of your own published about birds? And I know it's titled a Remarkable Book of Birds, not a Book of Remarkable Birds.
No, that's right. Well, I think the thing is...
We're remarking on it right now, aren't we?
No, as we are. I didn't want it to be... It's not like a field guide, an observation, you know, an identification book, because there are many, many of those, all of excellent. But this is more of a sort of a personal account of, you know, my own, you know, experience seeing birds through for many years.
I noticed that it's full of hand drawings that you've done of these birds. I mean, that must be very difficult to do, because they don't tend to sit still for very long, do they?
No.
So that's right. They have to be drawn in quite in haste, I imagine.
That's right, yes. A lot of them would be ones that I'd taken photographs of myself, or snapped, or, you know, I've just looked through my, you know, thousands of photographs and would pick one or two that I liked and use them as reference.
I'm always impressed by people who know the names of things, the actual names of things in the natural world. Are you impressed by that as well?
Yeah, very much so.
To name things.
Yes, I think so. I think because my grandfather, he was good with the names of, and he was a builder. He was a stonemason, and so he knew a lot about architecture and pointed out features. And my father was very interested in the natural. I mean, my dad is immensely curious about a lot of things. He's hugely, you know, collects classical music, and he paints, and he, you know, does illumination, which is sort of like the old-fashioned
manuscripts, right?
Manuscripts, and so on. And so he's always, you know, sort of absorbing things and information. And so he would teach me a lot about the names of things. Plants as well, that's his big thing. That's the thing I have to defer to his greater knowledge. But with birds, certainly, yes. It was something which I think when I became a father, I just realised it was almost like an urgency. I think I had to know the names of these things. I have to pass these on. It's like it's knowledge that I would want to know if I was a kid.
I think curiosity is the best remedy or the best defence against depression.
I think you're right.
Maybe unconsciously or consciously, you're trying to prepare or arm your son with that. Once you live this curious life of the participant, the person who knows, who wants to know these things, then it stays off that kind of sense of, I don't know, futility, sadness, boredom, ennui, all those things.
Yes, I would hope that would be true, yes. I think that it is. It's a corrective to those moments of introspection. I think if you... You know, I always find I find it hard to grasp when people are out and about and they're seemingly incurious about what's around them. You know, you think there's extraordinary wildlife around us. I mean, not just that, amazing. Just walking out in the countryside, there's multifarious things, plants and things and insects and birds and all the names, and just by scratching the surface, by getting into the names of these things and just finding out where they are, where they live, how they live, what the process of their life is, For me, it is. It's like you feel like you're part of this environment. You're not. We're not just passing through as kind of, you know, we're not connected to it in any way.
Yes, we're not bubbles just travelling through the world.
We're not bubbles travelling through. You know, you find... I read a book about owls, for example, say, or birds or anything about the world, the natural world. And, you know, you read something that somebody's written about, you know, 150 years ago, and it's still... You know, makes sense today. And I feel that by having that curiosity about the natural world, we're sort of, it connects us to the past, it binds us to the past.
Broadcast, podcast, and on the ABC Listen app. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
It sounds to me like you're trying to infect your son with your own sense of curiosity about the world. Did your dad do that to you as well, Bill?
Yes, he did, and my mum as well. I mean, she was very much a part of it. In fact, I think probably even more so when she was alive. She was an enormous sort of ball of energy, and she was incredibly enthusiastic about being outside. You know, she would repeat this as a mantra. I mean, of all the many fond memories I have of her, the one memory I have of her is, I think probably we'd be out somewhere and, you know, outside in the garden, and she would say to me, I want you to love nature. She'd just repeat it over and over again. And it sort of went in, it kind of lodged in my brain, you know, and it gave you kind of a mission almost, like a purpose, you know. It's like there's all of this to learn and all this to find out about. I want you to love it. Family outings were very much, were like these sort of, you know, communal meetings. We meet other members of the family, we go to bird sanctuaries, wetland centres. And it seemed like the natural thing to do, and I still get pleasure from it now. You know, whenever I've got a spare moment back home, I go to one of the RSPB reserves or something and potter around with the binoculars.
And are you often on the lookout for people who you can learn from?
Absolutely. Oh, one of the great perks of having some, you know, whatever you want to call it, notoriety, or you're in the public eye, you come to the attention of people who are sympathetic. And I've made programs. I've made wildlife programs, documentaries, programs about birds and so on. And one of the reasons I do it is because I get to meet these experts. I get to spend time with people who've devoted their lives to the study of the stone curlew. And, you know, and I just delight in their knowledge, their enthusiasm. And it's so infectious. And it's one of the great perks of this job.
I'm conscious that your life could have gone in a whole lot of different directions just looking over your bio, Bill.
Yes.
I mean, there was one point, you won most of the prizes in your school at a young age. And yep. there was one point where your English teacher was fighting over you with your drama teacher. Mm. What was it like to be in the middle of that wrangle,
yeah,
Bill?
That was
terrifying.
It was actually.
It
yes.
was more histrionic, the English one.
It was extraordinary. It gave me an insight almost into just adult behaviour. You know, like teachers are supposed to be these sort of almost quite sort of dull, you know, automatons. You know, you file in, they do that, and then you go away, and that's it. Oh, bloody Mr. Wilkins, what's he like? You know, and here was this guy, red faced, furious, in a stand-up row, you know, with another teacher. It was just what the hell? And arguing about my time.
Well, what sort of things were being said?
Well, you're taking up too much of his time. How dare you barge into my lesson like this? I'll do whatever I want. Well, I'm going to take this. It was just extraordinary. Extraordinary thing. I was just open mouthed. Like it was like a sketch.
It's almost like something that should be staged for the benefit of every student, isn't it?
I mean,
well, this is marvellous, isn't it?
This is great. Look at them going at it. They're like Siberian hamsters.
mine. So, but your music teacher was that one of those life changing teachers you get?
Yes, she was.
Wasn't she?
Yes, Linda Phipps. And she was, I always think of, so lucky to have met her. And she taught me the sort of more involved aspects of music theory and advanced grades of piano. So I sort of went through all the grades with her. She had a tremendous energy. She was like a fizzing with energy the whole time. And she encouraged me to go further. The great teachers make you go further.
They make you ambitious.
And they make you ambitious. They are diamonds. They are incredibly rare and wonderful people. And she was one of those. And in one of the recitals, she encouraged me to write and perform a cadenza, which is like a sort of extended virtuoso piece of basically showing off. The idea was that, you know, in the times of Mozart and so on, pianists were quite well known. They were sort of celebrities of the age. And so the composer allowed them to, you know, show off their virtuosity a little bit at the end of the piece. Sort of like, look at this. And it's like a guitar solo. And so she's encouraged me to do this and perform it with a chamber orchestra. It was a Mozart piano concerto, The Coronation. And there was no way on earth I would have done this without her encouragement. There's no way. It was just incredibly daunting. You know, I was a kid, you know, it was like 17 or something, you know, and then there's all these people there and all some dignity, the school, all your people in school. Like, and she just kept saying, no, you can do it. No, that's it. No, do it. No, keep practicing. You can do it. Her voice has been with me my whole life. The voice that says, no, you can go further and do this. And, you know, years later, when I was doing a stand-up tour, one of the biggest tours I've ever done, it was a arenas, preposterous, nonsense, really ludicrous, kind of foolhardy endeavour. And I'm standing on stage at Wembley Arena, and there's 13,000 people, and I'm just about to go on stage, and I hear her voice saying, yeah, you can do this. And that sort of calms you down. I think, yeah, I did it then, I can do this now. People like that have a profound influence your whole life.
And so why am I talking to Bill Bailey the comedian rather than Bill Bailey the accomplished concert pianist? Well, what diverted you from the path?
Do you know what it is? I think I love the spoken word equally as I love music. I remember going to see a poet, actually, and you probably know his name, John Hegley, who's a British poet.
Brilliant poet comedian, yes.
Brilliant poet comedian. And being inspired by him and thinking, what a wonderful Bondy got with his audience, and I'm spellbound, you know. He's in a suit and glasses, and he sort of talks in a rather kind of nasal way, and he strums a ukulele, and yet it was mesmerising.
And was punk music an influence on you at the time, Bill? Was that do-it-yourself ethos of punk, like stand on stage, write your own poetry, perform with the ukulele?
Exactly. It, very much so. It seemed to be like the essence of what the punk ethic was, which was like, no, you don't need to do all this, you know, get up there and do it. That really appealed to me.
I remember seeing you on stage in the Edinburgh Fringe of sometime in the late 80s, I think, performing with your first group, the Rubber Bishops, when you were two. Both you and your colleague performed in red cassocks, as I recall.
Yes.
And I think I have this memory of you carrying a Flying V electric guitar,
yes,
which I was envious of for the glamour because I didn't have that. But then I thought, you know, I'll never rest that on my knee, will I? I'll never successfully actually sit down and play that, will I? There's a problem with those guitars, surely.
There is. You've identified the main problem. You can't sit down and play them. They are meant to be played with one foot up on the monitor.
That's right. And going to comedy, like as opposed to music performance, there's a whole other thing when you're doing a comic music performance.
It just seemed the natural thing to do, and it gets people on another level. I mean, you'll know this. Music and comedy combined in the right way has a sort of power that neither of those two have. There's a kind of sort of synergy you get them. You get some, it's like alchemy. You don't quite know what happens. But if you can get that all to work, it gets people on a gut level. It's intoxicating sometimes, you know, and you see the effect of it and also playing it as well. And I thought, if I was just a musician, I would love that, but then I would feel I was missing out because I love the power of the spoken word.
Tell me how you met your wife, Kirsten, at the Edinburgh Fringe.
Well, I was actually doing a gig with the Rubber Bishops in a basement of a bar, and she happened to be there with a bunch of friends, and something about the humour or the something about the way we wear or the one or two lines just resonated with her. And she said, oh, that reminds me of when I was, you know, I used to sort of muck around and we had a band and we'd sort of do things like that. And it was one of those things. We just started talking. We went out to a bar with a bunch of friends and we were chatting away. And that night I'd got separated from a bunch of friends I was staying with. And so she said, well, you know, crash out in the flat with a bunch of flatmates. So I said, all right. So I crashed out on this couch in her flat. And then the next day, she was off. She was always doing things. She said, I've got a job, I've got to do this. But I made you some bit of breakfast and there's a cup of tea and see you later. And so I was so impressed with it. I sent her some flowers the next day. And then I wrote my address on it. And she wrote me a letter to where I lived. And so I then wrote her a letter, and we carried on. It just turned into this letter-writing courtship.
How long were you writing letters back and forth to each other?
Oh, about a year.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Living in separate places?
Yes, I was living in London on a houseboat, and she was living in Edinburgh. And we conducted this sort of long-distance relationship, I suppose. It seems quite quaint, really, when you think about it.
It's very romantic.
Quite romantic,
and very
really.
Old-fashioned.
It is very old-fashioned.
And were you trying to woo her with your letters?
Yes, I think I was. And I think that because of that, we had a greater understanding by the time when we eventually did then become an item, as it were. We'd already knew a lot about each other through these letters.
You got married in Indonesia, the two
yes.
of you. How did that come about, Bill?
Well, again, it was slightly sort of a bit of an accident, really. We were travelling through Asia. We were trying to go to Thailand, and on the day that we were trying to book the ticket, there was, we couldn't get a flight, so, we'll go to Indonesia. So we flew to Bali, and I've never been there before. And initially, I must admit, we weren't keen. It was too many people. It wasn't the kind of the holiday we were after. We were after some sort of get away from it all.
Remote, unspoiled.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's
yes.
right. And then there was, we were getting, do you want to watch and a kite? And do you want to get your hair braided? And we're like, yeah, no. And so just before we'd been out in Asia, we'd taken a rescue animal, a parrot, actually, a cockatoo, from the Moluccas, which is in the eastern part of Indonesia, the Moluccan Islands.
So you've got a long record of rescuing animals
yes.
then on the trot. Is it dangerous to travel to Asia with you?
You might end up with a Komodo dragon in your, in your hand luggage.
In your underpants, yes.
Yeah, could you just take that through? Yeah. So yeah, I was fine. It'd be fine.
I rung someone in London. Zoo.
Yeah, he's fine. He said no, he's fine.
No,
yeah.
Tickety boo. Right.
Yes. Just give it a bit of weak tea
and a steak.
And it's putty in your hands. And
so you'd rescued this parrot.
We rescued this parrot, and Chris said the parrot's from the Moluccas. Why don't we go there? And so we went. Yeah, all right. So we went. We flew to the regional capital of the Moluccas, Ambon. Then we got on a ferry and we went to this little island called Banda, which is in the middle of nowhere, a tiny archipelago in the Banda Sea. And it's just stunning. It's utterly just enchanting. It's like a little jewel. And there's a smoking volcano and old Dutch colonial architecture. And
it's the old Spice Islands, isn't it?
The original
yes,
Spice
yes.
Islands. So we just thought on a whim, let's get married. So there was a little church there, and we went to the vicar and we said, can we get married? And he said, he looked in his book and he said, how about Tuesday? And we went, yeah, sounds fine. So we just got it together.
And you've been there many times. Have you picked up Indonesian? Do you speak any Indonesian now?
A little, yes. Sedikit, as we say.
And what animals have you managed to bring back to London with you from Indonesia over the years, Bill?
A selection of dogs, actually.
Seriously?
Yes, yeah. Because got rather fond of a dog that attached itself to us, and one of these feral street dogs. And so we thought, well,
is that even possible to
yes,
bring a feral street dog?
It is.
To England?
It is. And another one was being sold in the market for satay. So we thought, again, we couldn't let that happen. So we bought him, Banjar, that was. Then we thought, well, we can't just have one, so we better get him a mate. And then, so we got two more.
Really? How many?
We've got five of them.
Five dogs. You've got five dogs
five
from Indonesia.
Street dogs.
And what if they bring some kind of really rare virus back from the jungle with them that kills all of Britain's dogs? What happens then?
It's yeah. right, like 28 days.
So-called dog lover Bill Bailey.
Yeah. Brings an apocalypse, a dogalypse to Britain. No, it was we checked them out. And
how are they doing? They're all right?
They're all fine.
Great.
They're all fine. Mealtimes can
do
be.
Do you expect them to be grateful? Because dogs don't know how to really do that. They wouldn't know that he was about to be made a satay, would he?
So, no, they wouldn't know that, no. But they're good, very good pets. They make fantastic house dogs.
Are you drawing the line at five, or could there be more?
No, I've drawn. Well, listen, I drew the line at two.
Then you bought an owl.
Yeah.
Now, Indonesia is important because a few years back you did this show where you retraced the voyage to Indonesia of a great figure of the 19th century, a man named Alfred Russel Wallace. I didn't know anything about him until I knew you were going to be talking about him, so I looked into him and he's completely fascinating. Tell me what you know of Alfred Russel Wallace, please, Bill.
Well, as you say, I was alerted to Wallace by my travels in Indonesia, because on a birding trip to the eastern end of Indonesia, the Eastern Moluccas, I had a book, a rather lovely reference book, The Birds, and it was called The Birds of Wallacea. And then I was thinking, what's this Wallacea? And Wallacea is actually an enormous swathe of Indonesia, from just east of Borneo all the way down to West Papua. So I thought, well, who's this bloke then? It's got this enormous bit of Indonesia named after him. And why? And so that sort of piqued my interest. So then, I read his, the most famous book that people may have encountered, which is The Malay Archipelago, which is his account of his travels throughout Indonesia.
And this is in the mid-18th, mid-19th century?
From 1854 to 1862, yeah.
Right.
And then I sort of started to dig around a bit more. And, of course, then you start to realise he, alongside Charles Darwin, independent of Charles Darwin, had come up with the theory of evolution by natural selection. Darwin came up with the theory privately and hadn't told anyone.
He was too frightened to publish, wasn't he?
Yes, he was too scared to publish, not really for reasons of religion. It was more that Darwin was a meticulous scientist and he wanted to be absolutely sure before he published. Wallace was an amateur. He was a beetle collector. He left school at 13. He wasn't educated, but he had this tremendous curiosity about the natural world, specifically about the species question. That was the big thing at that time, the species question. Why were there so many species? Why were they so many? You know, and did they change? You know, the Victorians thought that they didn't, that they were fixed by God. They used to call it transmutation. That was the kind of beautiful Victorian word for evolution. Mm. They just thought that God created things, then they went extinct, then he created more. And Wallace didn't buy that. And he and his friends, they went travelling in Brazil to try and collect specimens, to try and prove that there was change. And then all the specimens got lost in a fire. The ship sank, they nearly died. They came back to England with nothing. And if that was you or I think we'd just gone, yeah, well, we'll do something else, you know play at a bar or music. Or
that's and right, yeah.
Wallace said no. He was determined to try and crack this question. And so he travelled around Indonesia, Borneo, Malaysia, Singapore, all these places. And through his just determined and meticulous cataloguing of every single insect, bird, creature, he was curious about everything.
And can you see a path of natural selection through
yes,
these species?
Absolutely. Right. He was a collector, and he had to collect to finance his expeditions. You know, Darwin was a very wealthy man. I mean, he had a sort of stipend of thousands of pounds. He never had to work at all. You know, he was quite comfortable.
Oh, he was a gentleman scientist.
He was a gentleman scientist. So he didn't have to do it. Wallace had to. So he had to collect things. He would go out and shoot 10 parrots, and he'd look at them, and he'd see there were tiny changes between each one. Little sort of changes. Oh, that one's got a bit longer beak, that the colouring's a little bit different there. Same with beetles, same with insects, butterflies, all these things. And he'd lay them all out and think, there is a change. Look, that's that one there, and there's a slow, gradual change. And so he realised that only the fittest survive. That was the phrase that he hit upon. And he thought, that's true of animals. That was the key to him writing this theory.
Can you imagine how that thunderstruck? Like,
yeah.
Both he and Darwin would have been once that thought had suddenly, because it would have come to them in an instant, wouldn't it?
Would
that
have
thought, and then it would be like the ramifications of that thought.
The ramifications.
Yes.
Yeah.
So why do we remember Darwin, and why don't we remember Wallace?
Well, that's a very good question, because from 1858, when The Origin of Species was first published, 1859, sorry, when it was published, right the way through till 1913, when Wallace died, it was known as the Darwin-Wallace theory. Now, that was the accepted name for the theory of evolution.
The Darwin-Wallace theory.
The Darwin-Wallace theory.
So why did the Wallace bit fall off the end?
Well, there's all kinds of explanations. I think a lot of it is down to the fact that evolutionary theory fell out of favour after the turn of the century. It wasn't the fashionable theory anymore, for some reason. Darwin's book, The Big Book, you know, The Origin of Species, fell out of favour. People were sort of looking back to other forms, of earlier forms of evolution. Perhaps this wasn't right. Perhaps there was Lamarckism had a role to play, which is a more fanciful notion that we have some kind of weird fluid in us that changes us. It was not fixed. And so it fell out of favour. And then, of course, the wars happened. The First World War, and Hitler was actually a fan of Darwin. So that really put Darwin's stock way down, because it fed into his Aryan kind of belief of, you know,
Superman. Oh, might makes right, yes, you know, yes. Yes, the strong species will, exactly. Will the strong races will prevail over the weaker ones and more degenerate ones. That was his idea.
Exactly. And so it wasn't really until the 30s when Darwin theory was married with Gregor Mendel's work on genetics, and then that where we have the modern theory of evolution, which we know now, and by which time Wallace's name had dropped off the ticket.
Is he still remembered, though, in those parts of the world where he travelled to, in Indonesia, around Borneo, that part of the world? And what did you see of that when you went there?
I saw evidence of it. I saw people. There's people there, even by oral history, have passed down meeting him, you know, and actually having met him there, you know, their descendants of the people that actually met him when he was there.
What, in villages you're talking about?
Yeah, in little
here,
villages,
right.
Tiny villages. There's even in Ternate, which is the sultanate of Ternate, which is this capital of this wonderful little island, Halmahera. There was a mural on the wall saying, Wallace, Indonesian scientist, British, you know. And so there's even a contemporary appreciation of Wallace throughout Indonesia.
Maybe what's dogged him is that he had a great many passions, didn't he? He was an engineer, he was a fan of spiritualism, went to seances, did all that kind
Table
of thing.
Table knockers, you know, all of that.
That's right.
And, can you hear me, Mother?
Yeah. And he was involved in politics as well and wrote about economics. Maybe it's because, unlike Darwin stuck to the one thing, didn't he? And he did a whole bunch of different things.
Yes, that's right. Darwin was a sort of a steady, resolute accumulator of evidence. He knew that without that, you know, your reputation would be in tatters.
How much of Australia's natural world have you seen in your many visits here, Bill?
Quite a bit, actually. A few years ago, memorably, I was taken out to Werribee Sewage Farm.
It's a marvellous place there.
Outside Melbourne. Firstly, can I tell you, Werribee is spectacular. It's extraordinary. It's like going on some safari in Africa. There's hundreds of species of birds there. It's stunning. And there's no one there, obviously, because it's...
It's a sewage treatment works.
It was a sewage farm. That's the thing. Oh. All of that now is done with some modern equipment. So there's just various ponds. That there's a slight, the odd, you know, whiff. But if you're not so precious about that... I've been very lucky being up to Kakadu. I was up in Darwin performing, and we went out in Litchfield Park, and we had went up the lagoon, so crocs and amazing amounts of birds. Dived the Barrier Reef a few times. I've seen the birds there out on the Keys. There's extraordinary, huge flocks of seabirds. There's you know, unyielding desert and bush. It's like, and there's lots of things that want to, you know, just latch onto you. And
yes, that's
like
right.
It's a bitey Eden, I call it. I was very lucky, but one of the first times I came to Australia, in fact, the 20 years ago, just by pure luck and chance and the good hospitality of folk, my wife and I, we drove out into the desert. There was some friends had a sheep station in the middle of the bush, middle of nowhere, and that's what we did. And very few of the folk that we were with, and in fact, a lot of Australians in Melbourne I met, they said, well, what are you doing that for? Why do you want to do that? And we were, but this is to me, this is almost like, this is, you can't come to Australia and not see. This is the real Australia in a way. This is the kind of, this vast land, this huge interior that where people have made a living, where the indigenous population have lived for, you know, thousands of years and kind of sort of tamed it, to bent it to their will. And so we drove off for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours.
Just a long while to drive to the outback. Yes.
My auntie Gwen used to live in Perth, God rest her soul, and she never really got Australia. She immigrated from Portsmouth, and she would say, "Oh, you get in a car, you drive for hours and hours and hours, and then you get there, and there's nothing there." And I said, yeah, maybe, Gwen, but I don't know. I loved it. I loved the light. I loved the bird life, the expanse of nothing. It's unique. There's nothing like it anywhere in the world, and certainly not in Europe. One of the things I increasingly look for, I want to get away. I want to get out in there, but there's no one. And you can't get that in Europe. It's very hard. Britain's one of the most densely populated countries in Europe. I think probably the most densely populated country. There's swathes of forest and other things, but not just desert. Solitude, a 360 view. You can't get that anywhere else. I mean, parts of America maybe, but I don't know. It's different here.
Bill, it's been wonderful to speak with you. At long last.
Yes.
I've so enjoyed this. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. Subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
I spoke to Bill Bailey when he was touring Australia back in 2016. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.